All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum
freedom. Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Hello and welcome once again to the Read Rothbard podcast. We are back at it. We haven't been shut down yet. And we record these for you so that... You know, we save the NSA the hassle, I suppose. How you doing, Robert?
As if we were big enough to be shut down. I mean, maybe if we actually ever got listeners, you know, people would care enough. As it is, we're just two lone voices in the darkness screaming. I'm doing great,
so,
buddy. Living
that's
life.
Good. Good to hear. Our last episode was a nerd-inspired episode, and I thought that we could continue that trend a little bit on this one, though. I mean, honestly, all nine episodes have been nerd episodes, if you really think about it.
They contain nerds.
They do kind of look and taste like or sound like little rocks in the box. So I guess you could say we're as dumb as a box of rocks since we're nerds, nerd candies. I'm pushing this a little too far.
You are reaching. Yeah, so what are we going to talk about today, Dan?
Well, I was thinking that we could do the yin to the yang of Star Wars and go with the Star Trek. What do you think?
Now, as we all know, Star Wars universe is far superior to the Star Trek universe. Pretty much any character from the Star Wars universe outside of Boba Fett would destroy any Star Trek character. Maybe Worf might have a chance lasting a few seconds. But
Worf is, he's pretty badass.
He's got two hearts, two spines. He's got like backups of everything. So even if you like lightsabered his face and stabbed him in the chest, he could still slice me in half with his wicked, crazy Klingon blade. So maybe.
So we're going with the Star Trek episode, right?
Yeah, we're talking about Star Trek, Daniel. Pay attention.
Well, let's engage the Star Trek episode. I'm going to cue up some music here, so stand by for just a moment.
Engage.
Space, a final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
And here we are.
All right, I think everybody's been sufficiently prepped. They know what Star Trek is. They feel it. Yeah. So, since we're like a bunch of voluntarists, a bunch of libertarian anarchist type dudes, we're going to be approaching the Star Trek looking at episode from like an economic perspective, which could be a little bit difficult because there's never really one scene in Star Trek, and it's kind of difficult. I mean, you're kind of speculating on whether there actually was one, because you're in this, like, bubble. But we'll be speculating, and we'll be playing into how that ties in with current humans, some current humans on this planet, and their ideas of what Earth ought to look like. Notably, the Venus Project, most famously propagated by Peter Joseph, who has had a little bit of internet fame. He put out the Zeitgeist movies, and he has debated old Stefan Molyneux. And I don't know what he's up to lately. but we're going to be mostly going off of the VenusProject.com and what they're actually saying there and how they're basically modern-day Marxists with robots. And they claim to be ANCOM. Well, they don't necessarily claim to be ANCOM, but they're very associated with ANCOMs. In their own words, it doesn't work without some sort of hierarchy. Anyway, we'll get into that. So, Dan, you got any points to make before we get started?
Yeah, no, that's a nice summation of what we propose to talk about on this episode. We'll see if we can stick to that. We're usually not so good at it, but we can certainly try. One thing I want to note about Peter Joseph is, even though we don't know exactly what he's up to today, I bet he still has that mesmerizing way of speaking that just kind of sucks you in, and he uses all these strings of words together that sound so eloquent and amazing, but it lulls you into thinking that he actually is saying something when he's just throwing a bunch of words together. They just sound good, but don't mean much. Like he talks a lot about structural violence, and but never explains exactly what that is. I guess that's sort of like one of those social justice warrior type phrases. You know, it's like saying engineering ballhead, you know, mastication something. You know, it's like just making up shit.
Yeah, I think you could be lulled into listening to him, and I mean he's obviously very intelligent, but you could be lulled into thinking that. Like, if you ever listen to the Stefan Molyneux debate, you might think that he won the debate, just as an outside observer, just because he seemed, I don't know, more intelligent or what have you. I don't know. But if you get into actually what he's saying, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, he seems to evade a lot of direct questions and covers them over with this language that I was referring to. You know, so Steph would try to pin him down into simplifying the message to saying, well, basically you're talking Marxism with robots. He's like, no, I'm just saying that there's an inherent structural violence that suppresses the minorities, and we all need to come together through technology and sharing, and all human, you know, interactions can be brought together in harmony through the Venus Project, blah, blah, blah.
Right. And if you actually get into what they say, it doesn't allow for, well,
Let's go Star Trek, because we said we'd do that, and then we'll make our way back to Mr. Joseph. How about that?
Sounds good.
All right, so the Star Trek universe, which, you know, as you said, is not quite as nice and cool and sweet as the Star Wars universe, but there are some interesting, I guess, things about it that make it of interest to us. One is it appears to be a post-scarcity kind of universe, because they've got transporters and food replicators. They've also got like this, you know, diverse crew. It's one of the first shows that had, you know, people of different nationalities, different races, all in the same show. I think it came out in 1966, and so, you know, right, the civil rights movement. So I'm sure that was played a role in it, because it was like what was going on in of the day. But it seems to be, you know, one of those first pioneering inclusionary type shows. Another thing I wanted to mention is they appear to have like an overarching governmental entity that unites the entire planet and potentially like additional planets all under one world or one world's government. You want to add anything else about just kind of the environment of their universe?
Well, yeah, the United Federation of Planets, as I recall. And by the way, we didn't do any like research. This is us kind of talking about our memories of Star Trek. At least that is for me. I think I'm getting most of it right, and who cares? Doesn't matter. So yeah, there's the United Federation of Planets, and yeah, that would be like some sort of a one galactic government as some sort of ideal thing. Now, you could argue that every tyrant in history, every empire builder in history has been trying to unite the planet under one banner, trying to rule the whole world. And the one silver lining, I suppose, to that would be there wouldn't be any kind of like great internal war, you know, like you got a war, like a world war between the United States and Germany. Well, if they were both the same country, you wouldn't necessarily fight amongst themselves. That's the sold idea, right? Even though there are all kinds of horrific civil wars and all that sort of thing all the time. So even if you like the idea of one united, everybody working together, one giant ruling supreme power authority, it's not all raindrops and roses. You might be cutting out on the world wars, but what would you give up in exchange for that? You're still talking about domination and control. You're still talking about not self-ownership. You're controlled and owned by this supreme governing body, probably by people you've never seen, met. I mean, that's how it is today. People claim to represent you, yet they don't know you. You don't know them. You've never had a conversation. You've never met. You never even met in person. Never seen them. You've seen pictures of them maybe on TV, and yet they claim to have your best interest at heart. What a joke. So imagine that even exponentially worse. I don't know if it gets exponentially worse, but even more removed by having this one intergalactic government that is controlling all these planets. I mean, it's essentially the evil empire from Star Wars, but given a benevolent name, and it's never referred to as having internal strife. So, I mean, in the Star Trek universe, all you get is the perspective of the crew of the Enterprise and then the perspective of the people that they interact with on the planets they go to. But it's always the conflict between the Federation and the Klingons, or the Federation and, I don't know, who are those other guys? Who are those other guys?
The Ferengi? The Borg?
Yeah, the Borg. They come into it later. I don't know. It's always the Federation is always this unified, you know, good, and then there's all these external bad people. So, and that's a story that's told at the end of time, you know, how it's us and them and how those people are bad and we're good and endlessly. So, but as far as economy goes, it's you're talking about having food replicators and teleportation, and we can get into that. I mean, that just kills you and then just makes a clone of you somewhere else and you're dead. But economy is never really shown in the show. It's always like, well, we just have these resources. We just push a button and food appears. We just have it. It's never said how it's gotten. It's definitely, you never get the idea that people carry money, like it doesn't exist, or maybe just the people on the ship don't have it. I don't know. I think there's a few episodes maybe where they go back to Starfleet, and I guess in the movies where they're back on Earth, like especially in the reboots. But, you know, it's never really talked about. But, I mean, for our speculation sake, we can talk about how, you know, someone from the Venus Project, like an anarcho-communist who feels like we should just be having this resource-based economy and just everybody shares. And it's just all the commonly owned stuff, regardless of how horrific commonly owned stuff gets treated.
Yeah, you never rented a car, right? I mean, how do you treat a rental car, you know?
Yeah, I mean, when nobody owned the Buffalo, all of a sudden the Buffalo are all, like, gone. So we can talk about that. We can talk about just the idea that you push a button and all of a sudden there's food there. It seems to be what the Venus Project, and then these people are really, like, their fantasy, and just how unrealistic that fantasy is.
Yeah, it seems like they were watching Star Trek as kids, and then they grew up and they're like, hey, that's a great idea. Let's blend technology and Marxism, and we'll just push buttons, and robots will determine what we need and how much we need, and somehow no work will need to be done. No one will need to take anything out of the ground and create like building blocks of a structure of production or anything. Everything will just kind of happen and materialize because there's these robots and computers that can do it for us.
Yeah, and to be fair, I mean, maybe if you actually did have this technology in place somehow through the market already, and then you could transfer over, maybe we could talk about that. But it seems to be a dream of, well, humanity in general, to have leisure time, right? And it's kind of similar to this guaranteed basic income idea that, you know, if everybody gets a certain amount of income, just regardless of the horrific effects of that, the idea, the dream is, you know how unrealistic it is, that once you have your basic needs taken care of, then you are free to be creative and productive in all these other endeavors, regardless of, well, now that everybody's not working, who's going to make the stuff that you're actually going to be consuming? So you're just creating a baseline. You're making labor externally expensive, and then all the prices are going to get jacked up, and all of a sudden your basic income buys nothing. But it seems to be this idea that if we could just eliminate human labor from the equation, humanity could just be transcended to some other sort of greater purpose in life. And that seems to be the goal of these people.
Yeah, it almost sounds like they're taking a page out of Proudhon, you know, saying that once all your needs are met, then we can focus on more important endeavors and expanding our intellectual capacities and appreciation for the arts and try different things throughout the day. I think it's called a papillon. Basically, you can spend an hour a day doing this and then an hour a day doing that and just enjoy life, and all of your needs are met. And, you know, I would consider that privilege, if we're going to use that term at all, in that the fact that the market has made things available to you at a store near you or at a internet site in which you can push a few buttons and get things delivered in a day or two, I mean, that is privilege in that you're not scrounging around for food. Like, if there wasn't a market-based economy and there wasn't a division of labor, you would have to provide everything that you need for yourself. And, you know, no one's going to give it to you. And to think that they would, and to use the force of government to make that happen is just beyond the pale. I mean, you might as well be holding the gun yourself. In fact, I'd give you more credit for that.
Well, yeah, because you're actually putting your own life at risk. You're actually saying, hey, I want this thing so much, and I'm actually willing to take the risk to engage in violence to get it, instead of voting for somebody else to go and crank on the violence lever to do it for you.
So would you say that politics is diffusing the cost of violence in a way, so it makes it easier to use violence to get what you want versus going out into the world and creating value?
Yeah, so politics diffuses the cost of violence. You're spreading it out among, well, millions of people, the entire population. And it's actually put on the enforcers, like the police or whoever. But by voting and diffusing the cost, it makes it cheaper. So it makes it actually way more prevalent. If you actually had, if there was some guy who just wasn't doing something doing something he didn't like, he was smoking pot in his house or whatever, and I don't like that. If there was no political apparatus that he could vote and make that guy stop doing that, he would actually have to invest his own resources. He'd have to care so much about it that he would have to hire a guy or do it himself, which is even more expensive, but hire a guy to go over to that guy and physically stop him from smoking pot, build a prison in his own house or buy a prison, build a prison somehow, and incarcerate that guy, basically kidnap him and jail him, cage the guy, all on his own dime. That is incredibly expensive. It would be outrageously expensive. Pretty quickly you'd go, I don't care that much. I mean, who's he hurting? You would quickly get a real sense of, that really doesn't affect me. That's his own body, his own thing. He's doing his own thing. How quickly would you not, you'd get a real sense of perspective. Whereas now, you can go, well, I don't think he should be able to smoke pot, so I'm just going to check this box and we're going to institute a bunch of violence against him. Well, I don't really have to do anything. I just sit here, pay my taxes, and check a box every once in a while. I mean, that's no cost to me, like minuscule cost compared to having this violent apparatus that is at your beck and call, essentially.
But only for certain things, right? Because it's got to be, you know, democratically decreed or whatever. And it's kind of unfortunate that democracy, as flawed as it is deified in so many ways, and even the process by which it's intended to work doesn't actually function. Like the whole Brexit thing was about unelected people in Brussels dictating down to people in the UK what they could and could not do. You know, thousands and thousands of pages of legislation all the time with no feedback mechanism whatsoever, short of, you know, leaving the EU. And, you know, I'm taking this on a bit of a tangent here, so you can feel free to rein me back in, but I just want to bring up the inherent problem with the so-called utopian democracy and how it actually doesn't play out in the real world anyway.
Yeah, so let's bring it back to the old Venus Project. So the Venus Project, they're kind of associated with anarcho-communism. They seem to be for personal property, but against private property, but they don't really make a distinction about what that is. They have a problem with homesteading because they're against private property. But in the Venus Project, with a resource-based economy, their goal is a global system. So if you dissent, tough shit, where are you going to go? So as far as being an anarcho-communism thing where participation should be voluntary, because they're not for violence. They're absolutely against violence, and they're supposedly against hierarchy. But in their own words in the Venus Project, for this to be achieved, all resources must be declared as the common heritage of all Earth's inhabitants. My question is, declared by who? For who? As soon as one person on the planet says, no, I don't want you to take my stuff, or my stuff isn't for you, or whatever, that immediately enables violence and hierarchy. You're saying that I am above you, and I am allowed to take your stuff. In about hierarchy and voluntary basis is seems to be bullshit. And they're also incredibly vague. I mean, they talk, the whole website, they're always talking about how, well, if you just apply science and technology to a thing, then you get a thing. You get all this awesomeness. Well, I would argue that we're currently, people are applying science and technology all the time to these issues, to in their own, their according to their own desires. So I don't really understand what they're saying when they say, well, if you just apply science and technology, then we'll have this utopia. Well, that's what we're currently doing.
Can I slow you down for just a second? Because I want to make a distinction saying that we don't understand. Because that, to a listener, might be, oh, well, they just don't get it. So, I mean, we do kind of understand what they're saying, and we understand the fundamentals of economy. I mean, scarcity is a fundamental nature of the physical universe. You know, time is a scarce resource. There's only so much iron ore in the core, in the crust of the earth. You know, there's only so much of anything. So there's always scarcity. So to pretend that that doesn't exist because you watched a TV show about people, you know, some United Colors of Benetton crew flying through the universe when you were a kid, doesn't make scarcity go away.
Yeah, it doesn't. Sandwiches don't rain down from the sky just because you want a sandwich. I'm sorry, you have to work for it. And I know their argument is, well, just make this technology, science and technology, the magical ghost of science and technology to do it for you. What does that mean? They list all these different things on their website, like, well, we're going to, you know, we're going to use these different energy sources to power all their cities and all the things. Well, these are all things we currently use. They list solar, wind, wave power, tidal power, geothermal power, hydroelectricity power, thorium power, osmotic power, ocean thermal energy conversion power, underwater turbines. These energy sources are already in use, so I don't understand what they're claiming. Like, if we just use these more, make them essentially not market productive, not market efficient, right? We're just going to throw money at something until it eventually maybe pays off, maybe?
Two things. Number one, I find it curious that they don't include human power or labor, because apparently we're all supposed to be able to just become fat slobs like in that, what's that called? Wall-E? Yeah, where we're just all in these hover chairs and just getting fat and stupid, like Idiocracy, which seems like we're getting closer and closer to that every day. But the second thing I want to say, and then before I do it, I'll let you chime in, but I want to throw a Murray at these guys talking about scarcity and how much work goes into getting a frickin' ham sandwich. But proceed, and then I'll cue that up.
No, Wall-E's a good comparison. The inhabitants of Wall-E were on a ship for like 200 years, and they continued to eat like this smoothies. I mean, where are these smoothies coming from at that point? After 200 years on this one ship.
It is people.
It is. It's absolutely people. So I know they're just, you know, just a story, but it's fun to think about these holes in the plot. Anyway, go ahead. Let's hear what Murray has to say.
All right, so here's Murray on scarcity in nature and how you have to work to get anything and the amount of work that it takes and the time it takes for you to be able to get a thing as simple as a ham sandwich.
People, man, take natural resources and transform them in order to get to what? The consumer goods, so they can use it. In other words, Crusoe's got to eat. He's got to take the resource. He's got to shoot the deer or catch the fish and eat it. So he's got to do various things to get the consumer goods. The objective of working hard to do this is to line up the consumer goods. Line up with food, shelter, clothing, hi-fi sets, or whatever. These things are consumer goods, used as an end of themselves. So the objective of action is all about. Consumer goods are coming off the assembly line, so to speak. Everything else, which is not labor or natural resources, is called capital goods. Because capital consists of everything used in production, which is not land or labor. It could be the net, fishing net to use for fishing, pole if you're to fish, bow and arrow to hunt, anything like that. Anything right now, it could be roads, trucks, tires on a truck. All these things are factories, of course, goods in process. All these things are part of capital. So you get to the consumer. For example, if you just ate a ham sandwich at Michelangelo, let's take that. One of my favorite examples. The end process of millions of people engaged in production. By the way, what is production? Production is a transformation, the use of labor, working on natural resources to transform into capital, different types of capital, but finally you wind up with consumer goods. So production is this whole process of starting with land and labor and winding up with consumer goods with different degrees of capital. So for example, let's take a ham sandwich in Michelangelo. You have an enormous amount of cooperating factors in there. It's a whole production tree or structure of production, starting with a farmer and miner and so forth, going for about 30 years at least to get the ham sandwich. Okay, what do you got? You got different ingredients going into it. To produce a ham sandwich, to sell it to the consumer, you got to have a ham, of course. You have to have the bread. You have cheese, butter, yeah, tomato, lettuce. Okay, all these things got to be brought together on a retail level. And you have to have the workers and aprons and counters, okay? Yeah, you got to have counters and refrigerated units, you know, all that sort of stuff. And chairs. Somebody's got to produce the chair. You can sit on it. All these things have to be produced. They all have to be combined together in one ham sandwich. They have to be produced for many years. The ham is sold by a wholesaler, and they get it from a jobber, or it's like Eastern Seaboard. And they get it from Chicago. You got the meat packer, the meat packer. So, you know, package the meat at the slaughterhouses. Slaughterhouse gets it from the farmer, raises the pig. They have to have stockyards. They have to have trucks in every step of the way, and gasoline for the trucks and tires. I mean, on and on and on. It's only for the ham. The pigs have to eat, and they usually eat corn. The corn has to be grown, and on and on and on. With machinery every step of the way, and this is and all this, I said, just from one unit. And it takes 30 years, it involves millions of people for one lousy ham sandwich. It's incredible. And every country in the world probably is involved in this. People growing ebony for pencils in Africa and so forth and so on, which is then, because you have to have paper, you have to have pencils to record all this stuff and figure out what's going on. Always, but every step of the way, you have to have land, at least to grow on, you have to have different kinds of capital, and you have to have labor. The interesting thing is it works. But every step of the way, one of the amazing things about the market, the free market economy, is it all works. For me to get a ham sandwich right today, you don't have to have some world planning board, eight guys on the planning board sitting around 30 years ago, and say, let's see, on January 28, 1986, we have to get raw fire ham sandwich. Therefore, you got to go raise the pigs. You over there go raise the corn and so forth. Got to get raw fire ham sandwich. Nobody does that. There's no world planning board trying to figure this out. If there were, we'd all be in big trouble. And yet it all works. At every step of the way, all these things happen at every step of the way with no shortages and no surpluses. Everything fits together like a latticework structure. The market economy is like a latticework, like a lease thing. It all fits in. How come it all fits in? What? There's no planning board that fits it all, and the market itself does it. And really what microeconomics is the study of how the thing works and what happens when the government intervenes in the process and screws everything up. The big factor here, which is true both in Prusol and for us, the big factor is this. We contrast the world with what I call the Garden of Eden model. Now, some people believe mankind used to be in the Garden of Eden and was then kicked out for various transgressions. Whether it's true or not, it's an interesting model to look at. The Garden of Eden, everybody satisfies his or her wants in unlimited fashion, but no work, no nothing. Snap your fingers and Pepsi is trickling down your throat. Nobody has to work at it, nobody has to produce it. Why is that? Because there's no scarcity. If there's no scarcity, you don't need private property, you don't need labor, you don't have to work. Unfortunately, we were kicked out of the Garden of Eden if it ever existed. And so in the world as it exists, in human history, there's tremendous scarcity. You don't have unlimited abundance of all factors of production, of all goods. The Garden of Eden model is unlimited abundance of all desire for goods. Somebody wants to hear a symphony, they snap their fingers and get it right there. We haven't got that. We have to have somebody working to produce it. And so we have the ever-present fact of scarcity. Scarcity meaning scarcity of resources relative to the goals that we have and we've got to try to accomplish. Scarcity of resources, scarcity, we'll see in a minute what the resources are. Obviously, the scarcity of land, labor, and capital. Scarcity in the sense that we'd like to have more of it. If we had more, we could produce more and consume more. We have higher standards of living. If we had no scarcity, if everything was super abundant, we wouldn't have to work. We don't have to worry about anything. Just Pepsi trickling down our throat, just like that, or whatever equivalent. Well, what happens is, a caveman has everything that's extremely scarce. They're in bad shape. Crusoe was in bad shape. Everything is very scarce. He's going to die tomorrow. He's going to get food immediately. The progress of the human race, the progress of civilization, is essentially the alleviating of scarcity. Scarcity is still there, just with a lot less of it. A lot further from the brink than Crusoe was, or the caveman was. A higher living standard. So the progress of the human race is essentially the progressive diminution or alleviation of scarcity. Scarcity is still there, but just a lot less of it. In the intellectual world, they're sort of fashions. You know, one of the few good things about being at my advanced age is I've seen them all. You know, all the fashions come and go. Every 5 years, some new nut comes on. With a new theory, everybody adopts it for about 5 years and forgets it 5 years later. One nutty theory that came in about 1970 was there's no more scarcity. Economics, microeconomics might have been correct. For the old days, when there was scarcity. Now there's no scarcity. It's called, we live today, in the post-scarcity world. What does that mean? I don't know what it means. What it really would mean is we're back in the Garden of Eden. Nobody has to work, nobody has to produce. No, not. Obviously, we're not in that situation. I remember I had a debate with some turkey. I think it was the American University in Washington, which is an odd place anyway. I was on a question about, do we live in a post-scarcity world? He was maintaining we live in a post-scarcity world, therefore we don't have to work, and therefore, I don't know what the therefore was. They're all very murky. His conclusion was, we should therefore have socialism. I'm not sure why that was a conclusion. Presumably, if there's no scarcity, you can have anything you want. Deuces are wild. So I said, well, if it's true that Professor So-and-so is right, we live in a post-scarcity world, why does he tear off his paycheck? Why does he at least tear off his raises that he gets every year? Anyway, his answer was interesting. That's because I, too, have been sucked into the capitalist ethos. So it's an interesting reply. In other words, he's also saying, he's admitting there is scarcity, and he's trying to alleviate it as much as anybody else. That has been forgotten. I haven't heard that for a long time now about post-scarcity. As a matter of fact, the next fashion that came in shortly after that, I think by 1975, my God, everything is scarce. We're going to run out of resources. That was a big gimmick for about 5 years. From 1975 to 1980, the same jerks were claiming we live in a post-scarcity world, and therefore we should have socialism. I don't know how the therefore comes in. I can never figure that out. But anyway, then said from 75 to 80, we live, all resources are running out. Oil is going to run out. Energy is going to run out. Forests are going to run out. Therefore, we should have socialism. The conclusion is always the same. There's never any connection. Then you have to run around refuting that. And it turned out by 1980, they shut up after that because there's plenty of resources. I mean, there is scarcity, like there always has been, but there's plenty of resources. Nothing ran out. We'll get into the oil caper, by the way, fairly shortly. We get into the whole energy crisis, the alleged energy crisis, and all the rest of it. It's an interesting example of this stuff in action. So we have an ever-present scarcity of resources, and people therefore have to allocate their resources to the highest values, so their highest values, and try to make sure that they don't waste them, in the sense that they make sure they don't spend their time or their energy or whatever, and stuff they'll regret, figure that they really should have spent on something else. So this sort of, so these resources, by the way, also include time. Time is a resource, scarce, as you all know. What are you going to do tonight? What do you do for a block of hours from, say, 8 to 11 or something? You have all sorts of choices. Every person has a concrete choice. You can go to a whole bunch of movies, not all at once. See people, you can do homework. Each of you could probably get a list right now of 7 or 8 things you could do tonight. How do you decide what to do? Well, you decide on based on your own personal values, which you think is most important, which you think is more fun, whatever it is, you decide one way or the other. It doesn't have to be an excruciating decision. You don't have to spend 10 hours on it. Make a snap judgment. Economists, again, don't care about how long it takes to make a decision. That's not our bag. It's the psychologist or whatever. What we're interested in is the fact everybody's got scarce resources, everybody's got goals they're trying to achieve, scarce time, scarce money, scarce labor, scarce capital, whatever, and they're trying to allocate as best they can to the best possible advantage. If you pick a movie, a certain movie, movie X, and you go to that, it turns out it was a bummer, you think, damn it, I wasted time and money, wasted the money going to it, you also wasted time, you could have gone to something else, you could have done something else. So you're looking back, you figure you took a loss, a psychic loss on it. The other half was a good movie, you figure it's a psychic gain, you benefited from this. Everybody looks at it prospectively, tries to do the best he can, or she can. Looking back, he said, well, gee, that was good, or it was a bad action, or a good action. It was too costly, or it was a loser. You figure out the next time you won't go to the movie with this director in it, a movie with a particular actor in it, because often the same actor usually appears in the same kind of movies. So you learn from experience, hopefully. You do better next time, presumably.
And there you are, Mr. Murray Rothbard, on the Reed Rothbard podcast for the second time.
Boom.
So essentially he's saying that you can't just expect nature to provide for you without you lifting a finger. I mean, you got to do something, right? And there's things that you use to create the end goods that you're trying to achieve, or the means through which you're trying to achieve your goals. So there's capital goods and consumer goods. And then he kind of outlines that as the ham sandwich. And so I don't understand how the people in the Venus Project expect Star Trek replicators to just spontaneously exist in the world to provide for them when it takes work and labor and ideas and entrepreneurship and the ability to try things and fail and try things and see the fruits of that success to spur on technological improvement that they claim to be relying on in the first place. Your comments, Mr. Robert Johnson?
Yeah, exactly. They want to harness the science and technology that is created by human beings, but then not reward people for that ingenuity and heart and whatever. Like, we'll get to this point where robots will do everything for us, and then we'll be free to do just whatever. Well, that just halts scientific progress. I mean, just everything going to R&D at that point? Is that what they're saying? One of my huge issues with these guys and any kind of socialism is it doesn't take into account that human desire is infinite. So when you go to a free market supermarket, you have all this variety, all these levels of quality, all vying for your dollar. So there's 50 different kinds of cheese. Well, you go to any kind of like communist country, like any kind of where you essentially get like one cheese, because they're just giving you cheese. Like in the Venus Project, they claim to be able to account for human desire by having surveys. Well, imagine filling out a survey and saying, how much cheese do you want for the month? And, what kind of cheese do you want? And on and on and on, a million different things.
No new cheeses ever, because why would anyone ask for anything different than what already exists? So technological progress would essentially cease, and we'd be stuck at whatever level we started at.
Right. So, but also, you're going to pick the best quality cheese, and you're going to hedge on the high side. You're going to pick more than you actually need, because, you want to be safe, or maybe you're feeling like you had a little more cheese that one day or whatever. So in terms of efficiency, it's a joke. You're going to misallocate resources all over the place. You're not going to have prices, so you're not going to be able to correctly gauge exactly how much somebody wants a thing. A price is an indicator that a person is willing to give this much for this thing. So you know how much somebody values a thing. With no prices, with just resources, Well, there's no cost involved in saying, well, I want 100 pounds of cheese instead of 50 pounds of cheese. What cost is you to there for you? There's no cost. So why not do that? So you can't really judge how much somebody wants a thing or not. So you're going to have huge misallocations of resources all over the place. They claim about efficiency. It's going to be the worst. Every communistic country is always cribbed off of free markets because they have no idea how much a thing is worth. And they constantly are throwing shit in the wrong place for the wrong amounts at the wrong times. Right now, Venezuela is shit in the bed, and they have no idea what they're doing.
They can't even afford the toilet paper to clean up the shit in the bed.
They can't. They recently nationalized the toilet paper manufacturer, and they only closed down and fired everybody against government authority, apparently. Apparently, they're supposed to ask the government if they can fire their employees or not. They only did that because they couldn't import any of the raw materials needed to make the toilet paper at any kind of reasonable price. So because they have runaway inflation down there.
Yeah, it's funny how they took it over. They nationalized it, and then they proclaim that they're going to provide the toilet paper for everybody. But it doesn't solve the problem that they can't even get the materials needed to make it.
Right.
And one other point that I thought was funny is that they laid off, you know, 500 or 900 workers, whatever the number was.
Yep.
And we'll post the article down below. But the government said, well, they fired these people without authorization or without notifying us, and therefore we're taking over. It makes no fucking sense. I don't want to say I don't understand. I do understand. I understand, but I don't get it. Like, what do you think you're fucking solving? You're not solving anything. You're making it worse. You're making it worse. Venezuela, you're making it worse.
Yeah, it's what they do. And then they've recently employed the military to ensure that food gets proper food lines. Basically, the food process gets to where it needs to be. I don't know how you use the military to ensure that food gets to where it needs to go. The problem is that you've got price controls, which sets food, which allows food to only be sold at less than its actual value. So if it costs you, as a store owner, $5 for a pound of roast beef, and you can only sell it for a dollar, what's the incentive for you to have roast beef in your store?
The law. The law says you must.
The law. Well, if I followed the law, I'd be out of business tomorrow. Is that better? So you end up going into a supermarket, one of these places, and it's just empty. There's just nothing. There's nothing on the shelf. Whereas you go to a supermarket in any kind of free market, and you have this abundant variety just all over, people trying to serve your desires.
We've been sort of interweaving more than we thought we would. We thought we'd start with Star Trek and move over to Zeitgeist, and we sort of just threw all of it into the Ninja Vitamix blender, which, as an aside, can you believe that after 80 years of blenders being in existence, a couple of entrepreneurs came up with some different way of making a blender that made people who go to Costco think that they're worth $500? I mean, that's the market, man. You got blenders. There's a YouTube channel about people blending random shit. There's, I don't know who it is, and I'll try to find it and post it below, but there's a ad campaign about one of these types of blenders, and they're throwing in, like, weed eaters and rocks and, like, fence posts and blending it.
Well, it's just the idea that human desire is limitless, and you can't predict it. And the idea that you're going to have robots predict it for you or some survey predict it for you is ridiculous.
Right. As soon as you fill out the survey, it's no longer valid. Like, people change their minds. Value is subjective. Circumstances change. And like you were saying, without any means of gauging how much you actually need or what it's going to cost you personally, you're going to say you need more than you otherwise would, you know, because there's no and this is a word that is kind of lost, but economizing, which is basically taking what you have and determining what is valuable to you and how much you're willing to give up for something else. It's like the preference scale that Rothbard was talking about. And I'll leave it there. Right back to you there, Mr. Johnson.
I had a thought, and I was going to say something, but then I started listening to actually what you were saying, which I try not to do, and then I lost it. So we might need to get back on track some other way.
Was it about blenders, or was it about people being able to click on any of the Amazon ads on our page, and even if they don't want that particular item, even if they just start their Amazon search from one of our things and then they find whatever they want, you know, be it a blender, one of those $500 jobbies that can blend a fence post or a boulder, we'll get a little bit of commission. That would be nice, right? You want to support this show, all the hard work that goes into it. We're raising kids, living out in the mountains all by ourselves, writing books, making this show.
Yeah.
No obligation, you know? It's just if you want to. It's voluntary. We're all about the voluntary.
Right. It's voluntary, whereas I think even though the Venus Project claims to be voluntary, it's not. I mean, if these guys wanted to go to buy some land and have a little commune and just live and whatever, more power to them. They're not aggressing against me. Who cares? Great. Live your life. But they're claiming to want to start this global resource-based economy where what if you opt out? What if they give you one of these surveys or the robots declare that you need 2 pounds of cheese this month and you need more than that? You're not accounting for human desire. There will be resistance. There will be a market. And what happens in this utopia that they're talking about when someone says, no, I don't want to? Do they go and attack that person? Is there some sort of spontaneous human economy that starts up outside of this robot oligarchy?
Do the robots take over? Is it Skynet? Is it HAL?
Yeah, Skynet.
Are the Terminators going to come get us because we're not willing to somehow not labor yet create value and get everything we need? I don't understand how this works, and I don't want to say I don't understand. I mean, I understand that it doesn't work.
Right. I don't understand how it works in their mind. It doesn't make any sense to me.
But it's not a matter of it not making sense. It's a matter of that it just will not work. So we're failing to see how they perceive something that will not work as working. You know, it's like they have a psychosis. They have a mental disorder. And we don't see the voice in their head that's telling them that this will work is an aberration because it doesn't work. It breaks immutable economic law. Things are scarce. Even time is a resource that is scarce. You know, if things were not scarce, then as soon as you even envision the thought, your wish would be granted. You know, it's like everyone's got a fucking Aladdin lamp and no limit on the number of wishes. You know, none of this three wish limit crap. Unlimited wishes, unlimited everything for everyone. Free healthcare, free food, free everything. No cost. Who's going to work for anything? You know, we are going to be the fat people, but we're going to be in those hover chairs just consuming until we die. And we probably won't live very long because, like, how much exercise would happen? Like, if no one had to work for anything, what is the point of existing? You follow what I'm saying?
I'm blowing aside. You don't find out what you're really made of until you test yourself. And you're not testing yourself if you're just laying around being fed by a robot. If you don't have to actually work and produce anything and create any kind of value to survive, you'll quickly become this, and I'm going to be disparaging here, you're just going to be this lazy piece of shit. And that is a lot of what you find, and I'm not trying to rip on people that are just like on the government dole here or government workers. But when you don't have to compete, you end up not competing. You just get
by.
So if government has these monopolies, these violent monopolies, where you can't compete against them, so they provide these services. And we don't know if they're the best possible service. We have no idea because they don't have to compete against anybody. We don't know if the cops we have are the best possible cops. We don't know if the firefighters are the best possible firefighters. Because how would you know? So when you don't compete against somebody else, you don't have to compete. And I'm not saying they don't work hard, and I'm not saying they don't train, and I'm not saying they don't do any of that stuff. But when you're not, it's not like, when there was the dream team in the Olympics, it was hardly the most interesting, compelling basketball you could watch. Because you had these guys who just cruised and dominated, and they were not challenged in any way. So was there any incentive for them to work harder? They're already number one. It's like that T-shirt. Andre the Giant, he didn't work out. He was already the hugest, most dominating force on the mat. He didn't have to exercise at all. When you have competition, it strives. It gives you incentive to work harder and to innovate and to just to create a better product, man.
You mentioned competition, and I think that we should define that a little bit because we're not saying competition in the sense of like a sporting contest where there is only one winner, like it's a zero-sum game. We're saying that competition exists so that things are improved or prices are lowered, but that doesn't mean that there's only one winner. Different people value different things at different levels. Value is subjective. So, you know, there could be a company that comes out with a solid gold chess set, and they are outcompeting everyone in the solid gold chess set market, but their chess set costs, you know, $5,000 or whatever. But that doesn't prevent anyone from making a stainless steel chess set or a wood chess set or a plastic chess set and on down the line till you get, you know, the $1.99 chess set or the dollar store chess set. You know, so we're not saying that competition eliminates anyone from any particular market, but it makes it more efficient for those who wish to specialize in an area to drive down their costs, drive down their prices, and service their customers in the best possible way. But it doesn't mean eliminating choice. You know, the inefficient firms will either go out of business or innovate, and they'll come up with some alternative. And there's always going to be a market for some kind of alternative.
You have no choice as to what fire department services you. You have no choice as to what cops service you.
Exactly. And then the Andre the Giant, I just want to mention him. Like, he was naturally a very, very large human being, and being such, you know, he was very difficult to defeat in the scripted wrestling matches that he was in. But he also died at the age of, you know, 47 or something like that, because he didn't have to work out to be large, and he had a big drinking problem, I think. And he's also the inspiration behind the Obey street tagging, which we borrowed for our Reed Rothbard imagery that you guys have seen as our profile picture, which I just changed today to something a little bit more just stark and a little bit different. So, you know, come down to Facebook.com, Reed Rothbard Club. Check it out. And if I can move us back to the direction of the ANCOMs just for a second. There's a meme on Anarchy Ball, and I fillet Anarchy Ball a little too much for this show, but they're good. And I've realized that it's more than one person, which is cool. It's like this group of people joining together to create all this content that is, like, pretty fucking awesome. But they have this meme, and I'll post it below, where it's Anarchy Ball on the left and ANCOM Ball on the right. And ANCOM says, "I don't need you." And Anarchy Ball replies, "Fine, fuck off then, and build your commune with your comrades. I don't care." And ANCOM says, "No, I can't. I need to take over your company instead. That's how much I don't need you." So he's making fun of the idea that the workers want to take over the means of production, as if the means of production are just some magical thing that just comes out of the ether. You know, like no investment has had to occur, no entrepreneurial risk has had to be taken on. It's just things need to exist, and once they do, we take them over. You know, it's a fucking Venezuela all over again, right? And I leave it to you, Robert.
No, you're absolutely right. I just want to bring it back to Andre the Giant for some reason, because it's a fun little thing. Andre the Giant, yes, he was a famous drinker. And in one sitting, a man confirmed that he witnessed Andre drink 156 16-ounce beers in one sitting. Pretty good. Pretty good.
So do you mind if we bring back some Roddenberry stuff? Because the guy was interesting. I mean, he did bring about the first show that had a bunch of different diverse peoples on the same show. I see things saying that he didn't want to focus on adventure and violence, so he was reluctant to have, like, the phasers or the guns in the show. Do we want to comment on that at all?
I didn't know that. They did carry phasers. If he was hesitant to do that, was he of the mind that there would be dramatic tension just from the conversations that he'd be having, or that he would be able to solve problems through intellectual discussion, which would have been cool, I suppose. I don't know who had them have the phasers on their persons then, other writers, I suppose, because he didn't really have a whole lot of direct contact with the show, influence on the show after the first year, is that right?
Yeah, that's what I was reading about. He had a lot of direct control over the very first season, but then due to ill health and drug addiction, he was not able to contribute to later episodes. He was reluctant to have the violence be a factor and the weapons be a factor in the shows, but it sort of came out later on.
Yeah, I mean, those shows all hold up. You still watch them today and be entertained, but I don't know what kind of storylines he was doing for a space adventure show without any kind of conflict. I mean, there was conflict in every episode. I have to go back and look. Maybe they didn't shoot any of the tribbles, probably. Don't know.
Yeah. So just to comment on Roddenberry a little bit, I will be posting a link to the top 25 quotes by Roddenberry, and a lot of it's actually pretty decent stuff. he apparently was fairly leaning towards being an atheist. And so there's some good stuff there. There's a few things that, we would disagree with, and some commentary about the Star Trek original series would be that they got the feeling that he was a leftist collectivist. And in fact, one of his wives said that he was a communist. And so he uses, say, the Ferengi as a straw man for the market economy and portrays them as either silly or evil.
This is speculation, right?
Yeah, and that's what this show is. It's all about speculation, right?
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I don't know if that's ever been said or whatever, but if it's true, then because, you know, the Ferengi are the black market element where they're going to get things for you. So there is some sort of the Federation has declared certain things to be illegal or illicit or what have you, but you can still get them through these Ferengi people who are still operating through the, what, archaic means of capitalism. Is that we're thinking? And this is according to my memory. I have to go back and watch some.
I would agree with that. And I think that it was intentional to portray the Ferengi in a negative light because they were quote-unquote black market. And that leads to the discussion of our previous couple of episodes where, you know, once you make something illegal, you're making a direct tie to violence to prevent it.
Right. You're counteracting human desire. People want a thing, they will get a thing. So what you're saying is that I'm willing to institute violence against somebody to prevent them from obtaining a thing. And are you the violent thug at this point? I would say yes, you are initiating force against the person who just wants a thing. You have no right to say whether or not another person has any right to a thing or not, just as much as they don't have the right to tell you whether you can have a thing or not. So when you declare a thing to be illegal or illicit, or to say that someone does not have a right to a thing, to own a thing, to possess a thing, you are saying that I will institute violence, I will initiate force against someone to prevent someone from getting that thing. Well, that turns you into the thug. That makes you the immoral actor. You are the one initiating violence. You're violating that person's self-ownership. And you're saying that I have the right, not only do I have the knowledge that you ought not have that thing, but I also have the right to prevent you from not having that thing. And that works both ways. So then someone else has the right to tell you that you don't deserve to have a thing, and they have the right to initiate force to stop you from getting that thing. The whole thing is bonkers, but it happens all the time.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's the world that we live in. And this podcast and a few other outlets are what I would like to consider the voice of sanity fighting against that mass psychosis that's out there.
Yeah, but as we talked about, when you have the violent arm of government, it makes it incredibly easy and makes violence very inexpensive and cheap to just write down on a piece of paper, hey, it's okay to attack people for having this thing or that thing, or people shouldn't be able to do this or that. Whereas if you didn't have that violent arm of government, this mass apparatus of power and destructive capability, to actually go around and prevent people from doing things just because you didn't want them to do it. Not that they were harming anybody else, but just because you didn't want them to have a thing or to do a thing, it would be exceedingly expensive.
No, I'll agree. And if you're ready to perhaps move on from the Star Trek Venus Project, I know that normally we do an Uber segment, so maybe now would be an appropriate time. Do you have one in mind?
This kind of gets into a larger issue. You know, it seems to be that Uber is the kind of like the whipping boy of the media. I don't know. You put out a negative Uber news piece, and you get a bunch of eyeballs on it because, I don't know, it's in the news a lot, and people are just looking for excuses to hate it. I don't know. Anything that has to do with sharing, anything that has to do with more efficient use of resources, anything that stops, you know, that impinges upon an entrenched monopoly.
So are you saying that there's a bunch of negative press about the Venus Project? Because it claims to be more efficient?
I don't think anybody really knows about the Venus Project. I think it exists in limited philosophical circles.
So they had their 15 minutes of fame, and now, you know, other than this podcast, like bringing them back up, like they're no longer a thing, right?
Well, their website still exists, but you don't see them out chatting it up. I mean, ANCOMs, you really have to look for them. I don't know. They exist, but... Anyway, so back on this discussion about the Uber thing. So there was a guy who robbed a bank, and he essentially did the old, I'll write down on a piece of paper that I have a bomb, and he gave it to the teller. and said, you know, I'm robbing you. Give me a bunch of money. I've got a bomb. And he probably waited until his Uber ride had arrived. I don't know. Probably. But then he walked out of the bank with the money and got in his Uber ride and apparently told the driver where he wanted to go, what have you. The cops tracked him down and found him stuck in traffic and arrested him without incident, apparently. But the news article was, you know, Uber used in bank robbery, which I suppose, you know, it's fairly newsworthy. It's the first time I've heard of such a thing happening. But, you know, here's another negative thing. It popped up as, you know, Uber did this or Uber driver does this, regardless of whether or not it is relevant. So the past couple ones have been relevant, like it happened during an Uber ride or the guy was an Uber driver or what have you. But there also seem to be articles that are like, Uber driver does this. Well, does it have anything to do with him being an Uber driver? No, he just happened to be an Uber driver. It would be akin to reading, having the profession of every person who ever commits a crime in the article. So plumber does this, dentist does that. I mean, do we really think that, you know, plumbers and dentists and librarians and whatever are somehow responsible for the crimes? It could have just as easily been his own car or a taxi, but it wasn't. It happened to be an Uber, so of course they're in the headline. And it just, it leads to a, you know, an internal, a journalistic integrity type discussion where it seems like they're looking for ways to spin it, which is nothing new, but there's a whole lot of pushback against any kind of sharing, ride sharing, Uber. Did we discuss the, do you remember? It was about how it didn't exist in one place. They've essentially been taken out of, what is it, Hungary? I think Budapest?
Maverick is supersonic. I'll be there in 30 seconds. Uber to suspend operations in Budapest. All right, here we go. Uber has announced today that government measures have made it impossible for the company to continue to operate in Hungary and will suspend its activities in the capital city of Budapest. The Hungarian parliament passed legislation in June that virtually bans Uber's operations. While not naming Uber specifically, the legislation says that authorities may block access to car services, including mobile applications and websites, for as long as 365 days if the operator fails to comply with its regulations. And they're basically claiming that Uber should adhere to existing taxi regulations that set prices, price controls, dictate which car models are used and allowed to be used, what age and color they should be, that they must be painted yellow and must be driven by licensed chauffeurs and have livery plates.
So you could imagine if some guy just wanting to just work for a few hours, you know, after work or on the weekends or something, just to pick up people and make a couple extra bucks, that he would have to go through that kind of ridiculous, onerous preparatory action to paint his car yellow, to have it be a specific make and model, how old it can be, get a license, get a chauffeur license, get some sort of a livery plate. I mean, just ridiculous. Ridiculous. This is insane protectionism on account of for the entrenched taxi industry. And the entrenched taxi industry actually, they blockaded the historic Budapest Bridge, demanding a ban on Uber, and it looks like they got it. But these are people that don't want to compete. They don't want to have to compete. They think it's unfair that they should have to compete against anybody else. They don't think they should have to actually provide a service that people want enough to pay for it. So they think they should have some sort of violent government actors cracking down on anybody that's trying to give anybody else a ride. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. This is getting paid for picking up somebody and driving them someplace. You don't need any special apparatus other than a car to do that. Or, you know, you need a car. In some places you have, like, a little bicycle. You can do that. You don't need any special knowledge. You're just doing a thing. So, anyway, these are violent thugs who want to force other violent thugs to act on you trying to make a buck, trying to provide value to your fellow man.
Well said, Robert. And I'm thinking that maybe our next episode could be about the taxi industry and Uber almost in its entirety. Not that we want to become the Uber podcast or the Uber show, but I can pull up some more Murray arguments. Taxi services and medallions and the whole process by which they sought protection and all that. I think that would make for an interesting conversation. And then we could put the rest of Uber to bed, right? We could move on?
Well, it wouldn't stop the new Uber news, but having fully, thoroughly covered it, it'd probably be a good thing instead of just having like your weekly Uber segment. I don't know.
No, I think that'd be fine, and then then we could kind of let it rest for a bit, and unless things get like super crazy weird, then we'd have that foundation to draw back on.
Yeah, we could reference that episode. That would be good. But yeah, it won't stop new news. It's only 6 years old, and it's sweeping the world, and there are all kinds of entrenched monopolies that are resisting it. Strictly from a competition standpoint, strictly from, hey, we shouldn't have to provide an equal service. We shouldn't have to compete against these guys for whatever reason. I mean, imagine if any other company said, hey, I shouldn't have to compete against anybody else. We were here first. We shouldn't have to deal with any new competition. What if the first refrigerator manufacturer had said, hey, we have the exclusive right to ever make any kind of refrigerators, and there should never be any other refrigerators ever made, or Sony or Microsoft or whoever. Anytime anybody else enters the marketplace, should say, no, we don't have to compete against you guys. I mean, it would be absolutely ridiculous. Where would innovation be?
You know, it's funny because that's how a lot of antitrust and patent law is applied, is to try to shut down competition in those ways.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's for like, what, I don't know, a long time.
Well, just so we have the trifecta of nerdery, and because we brought up the Pokemon Go last time, would you like to touch on a story or two there before we wrap things up?
If you got anything. I know they're going all over the world, and I know that there are some people. One guy wrote an article about how reality is for some people. I mean, there's all kinds of like disabled nerds, and how hard it is for them to play Pokemon Go. But, that's...
So that's like an inclusionary complaint?
I think so. I don't know if it was the author of the article looking for anybody to complain about it. I don't know if any of the disabled people were actually up in arms about it. I hope not, because it's
no offense to disabled people without arms.
Right. But yeah, what do you got for Pokemon Go, Dan?
Well, other than that nugget, which I don't think there's much to be said. I mean, if you're a listener of this podcast, you kind of know where we stand already. But I did link to you, Robert, a Onion style article about Edward Snowden. It was kind of an April Fool's-y type thing, though, in July, which is weird. But it was talking about how criminals, use Pokemon Go to draw people out. So they said that Edward Snowden is an avid player of Pokemon Go, and so an extradition team was in Moscow and planted a Pokemon nearby Edward Snowden. They brought him out and caught him. I mean, it was a thick article, so don't panic, people. Don't panic. But it sort of brought about that whole like being able to bait people and trap people kind of a thing, and I'll post it below. It's a lark. It's not real, but whatever.
Yeah. In other Pokemon Go news, I think the campus police for the Texas A&M, they had a couple of Pokemon Go incidents. One guy apparently just stopped his car in the middle of the road to catch a Pokemon, and then he got rear-ended by the car. Not expecting a car to be stopped there, they don't want Pokemon players to be in Auschwitz, because I think it disrespects all the people that were murdered there. It's an interesting phenomenon. It seems like there's Hollywood is now scrambling to get a big Pokemon movie going because they didn't understand that there's a huge rage and demand for Pokemon. You got all these people that grew up playing it that are now adults, and you know what happens when nostalgia kicks in? Stuff becomes like super valuable, and nerds with all this free money, spare money, collect things they liked in their youth, which led to Transformers costing like hundreds of dollars and thousands of dollars, and Star Wars figurines costing hundreds of dollars.
Are you saying that the free market is responsible for that car accident in Texas and the two guys in California like following a Pokemon off a cliff? Are you arguing for the resource-based economy because that would eliminate this type of nonsense?
I'm arguing that those people made those choices because that was their preference to do that at that time. And that those people own themselves, and they are free to do that. If they want to jump off a cliff to catch a Pokemon, then you can do that. Hey, that's your preference. Go for it. You are responsible for your own actions. Don't blame some stupid phone app.
No, I agree. I rented, or not rented, but I was provided a service vehicle when I drove down to that Mises event in Seattle a few months ago. It has what's called intelligent GPS. it knows if there's an accident on your path, and it tells you to go an alternate route. And so this should be like this great boon in technology and help you get through a situation faster and with less of an issue. But it took me over 5 hours to drive what would have normally taken over just over two. And this is because a whole bunch of other people also have this intelligent GPS, and apparently it doesn't account for construction going on the roadways. So it told me to go three times an alternate route. And one of those times, the on-ramp that it wanted me to use to get back onto the freeway after going around an accident was unavailable. It was closed due to construction. So I had to go through a highly congested downtown area along with 1,000 other people at the same time. And then when I got further along, it had me go on some weird, like, side road that was so, like, dangerous. It had all these hidden driveways and twists and turns. And a whole bunch of other cars were going on it because they had the same thing. And it ended up taking me, like, almost twice as long to get home. And I don't know where I was going with that, but it was like this supposed improvement in technology, and I followed that advice, but it took me longer to get home versus just slowly proceeding past the accident as you would have in the normal situation 10 years ago.
So you got bad advice.
I did. I started ignoring that thing because I realized that it was taking me forever to get anywhere. And it was only because I was in this, you know, new fancy car with this advanced GPS.
Right, right. Well, that's a market force. And, yeah, if people don't, you know, if you get bad advice from this new technology, maybe you'll follow it less and use it less. Or some other different technology that'll be better. Or maybe you'll go back to using your own judgment, like human beings used to do.
Yeah, and that could be a topic of a whole other episode. But I think we've started to wind down here. So do you have any other update on what's going on with your book and the merch and the other ideas that you have?
I've developed a new technique for drawing or illustrating my it's not a new technique, it's actually an old technique, but it's a new technique for me. It's a faster technique, it's a more dynamic technique, and it ends up with a more dynamic image, in my view. So that's been fun to do. I know that we promised to have an image on the previous episode. Now, has that been posted yet? It has. Right?
The previous episode is technically posted, but the Facebook thing goes out tomorrow morning. But I do want to mention that I have been going back through our previous episodes and adding additional content to the notations and the citations and references. So I consider them to be somewhat of living documents, as some people consider the Constitution. So, you know, I can add stuff later.
Okay. Well, I do have at least one image, maybe two images we could throw underneath the podcast that we promised or that I promised. So, yeah, things are looking good. I'm really happy with the way things are looking. That's all the update I have.
Still, well, that's pretty cool. I appreciate that, and I thank you for your time devoting to this this here podcast. This is episode number 10. I can't believe we made it this far. There's going to be a bunch of notes down below this one, and like I was saying before, they may change over time, so we'll continue to add content. We do appreciate if you do have any feedback or comment. You can make comments on our Facebook page, on the readrothbard.com website, or even on the Podomatic where we host our podcast. So many ways to get a hold of us. Robert and I have talked about creating some email addresses if that is something you're more comfortable with. So I'll look into that and we'll provide the information for that on a future podcast. And I just want to mention that we do have some Amazon links on our website. And if you do happen to make a purchase after clicking one of those links, you do support us in a small way. So we would appreciate that if that's something you're inclined to do on a purely voluntary basis. And, you know, this may be one of our most rambling podcasts yet. However, I've been thinking that about almost all of them, and then when I'm done grinding the sausage, it actually sounds pretty good to my ear. So, you know, perhaps this one won't be as bad as I think it is right now.
Yeah, we always, I think whenever we finish an episode, we're like, well, that was terrible. But I tend to agree that this one was even less coherent than normal. But, you know, whatever. It is what it is, man. I still have fun.
Yeah, well, we do appreciate you guys joining us if you did. And, you know, thanks again for coming. And we're going to energize.
Energize.
Peace out, homies.
Take care, everybody.
the chipmunks. C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do-do. Do-do-do-do. Do-do. Do-do-do-do.